The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, I'm Benita Cooper, Executive Director and blogger at thebestdayofmylifesofar.com. You might have seen some flyers of us at the welcome table. If not, pick one up when you leave. We are a multimedia, multi-generational storytelling project, and we're actually having an event here in this room next month. It is my honor to be here and introduce Nicole Krause, author of the new book, Great House. Before we begin, please take a second to check that your cell phones are off and please refrain from any photography. It's not easy to write well, with both soul and craft, boldness and delicacy. It's not easy to wrench hearts from cover to cover, yet perfect every sentence along the way. It's not easy to reinvent punctuation. It's not easy to speak volumes by composing silence. It's not easy to be funny. It's not easy to nurture heartbroken characters into uplifting stories. It's not easy to create a character that takes the literary world by storm and is deemed an instant classic. It's not easy to write one phenomenal book after another. It's not easy to score a raving review front and center in this week's New York Times Book Review. Yet Nicole Krause has gracefully done it all. Please join me in welcoming the talented Nicole Krause.
It's not easy to get people to come to your reading when the Phillies are playing either. But here you all are. So thank you for coming. These are still sort of early days for me and having this book out in the world and meeting readers, and I haven't done all that many readings. So I thought I would do something, rather than just read to you tonight, I thought I would do something a little bit different. I thought I would read to you and tell you about the book. But I'm going to read to you from something I wrote, which was basically for myself, to sort of remember where this book that I worked so hard on came from, which is something that one tends to forget as the book gets handed and becomes, well, all of yours. So let's see how it goes. There's something strange that happens at some point between when one turns a novel into the copy editor for the last time and the day it's finally published. The book, which for so long was something elastic, shifting to accommodate each new thought, every nuance in the writer's mood begins to harden. One discovers that the chair that yesterday could be dragged across the room is now nailed to the floor. The novel begins to close itself to the writer who built it out of her private concerns and instincts. She who knows its measurements exactly, who invented its inner workings, begins little by little to forget how it was made. The more the novel becomes a solid thing in the world, the less access the writer has to the accidents, reversals, inventions, rejected ideas, passing weather, sudden triangulations, and unshakable intuitions that led to those words, and only those, standing there on the page with an authoritative air about them, as if they were always bound to be. The writer who locked the door not long ago loses the key. So I thought I would try to record, before they slip away, how certain elements of my novel, Great House, came to be, where they arrived from and the unexpected transformations they underwent as they became underground forces in the writing. The novel is told in four voices, but the stories they each tell and how they fit together in the book and the larger story they sum to I won't say much about all that here, but we can talk about it in the Q&A if you want. Instead, I'm going to tell you about a desk, a shark, and a room that ceases to exist in one city only to be reassembled many years later in another. So here's the desk. A year after my first son was born, I started to write again. It had been a long time since I'd written anything, and what eventually emerged was a short story about a writer in New York who, in the early 70s, inherits some furniture from a young Chilean poet named Daniel Varsky. Varsky returns to Santiago, and not long afterwards is kidnapped by Pinochet's secret police and never heard from again. I've been interested in Chile for a long time, first as an almost imaginary place at the end of the world, which is how it appeared in my last novel, The History of Love, and then as a real place where thousands of people were disappeared, often tortured before they were murdered. I became consumed with what happened to these people. I read every book on the subject, and I saw every documentary, and made it difficult for myself to sleep at night. I suppose I sensed in some way that the nature of my horror and the need to see it through to its extreme had to do with a bottomless fear that I felt for the first time when I became a mother, the fear for my child's life, and the sense of being helpless to protect him against so much. But the short story I wrote didn't become about motherhood, not directly, or Chile, or Pinochet, or even the disappeared about whom I'd read so much. Instead, it became about that young American writer who later becomes a published novelist and who, for the next 27 years, writes at the desk of her friend, the dead poet Daniel Varsky. So it became a story about a desk. A story about a desk, and I suppose the burdens of inheritance, something else I found myself thinking a lot about as a new parent. So the story was published, and about half a year later, it was collected in an anthology. The editors asked for a paragraph about how the story came to be. I sat in my study at home trying to think about what to write. And as I thought, I looked up, naturally, at my own desk. And I say up because, and here what began in that moment to dawn on me will perhaps already be obvious to you, the desk I write on at home is a rather monstrous thing with a vertical wall of drawers that rises up from the desktop, just like the one in the story. In fact, and I'm aware this is going to make me sound oblivious, but the resemblance between the desk I'd spent a story writing about and my desk, the one at which I wrote the story, hadn't occurred to me. It was what I've come to think of as a blind spot, a kind of trick the writing mind plays on itself in order to preserve its freedom, to invent things unhampered by reality, to go places it might otherwise not have the courage to go. So here's the paragraph I ultimately wrote for that anthology explaining the origin of the story. I inherited the desk I write at from the prior owner of my house, who had it designed to his esoteric specifications. It's a monumental piece of furniture, far bulkier than any I would have chosen for myself, and I use it mostly because I have no idea how to dismantle it and get it down the stairs, and because I don't think anyone else would want it, which seems to me sad as well as a waste. Before moving out, the prior owner had a handyman dislodge a long rectangular painted panel that had been set into the shelves and which must have been valuable to him. So it left a gaping hole in the woodwork centered right above my head, and I've never known how to resolve or fix this hole. It's an ugly hole, and at first it seemed necessary to do something about it, but with time I've come to reconcile myself with it, or at least with the idea that the hole and the desk are part of a burden. But the story quite literally doesn't end there. A little more than a year after I published it, unable to stop thinking about that writer and her inherited desk, I returned to the story again. What would happen, I wondered, if that desk she had written at for 27 years were taken away from her? That story became the beginning of a novel whose many parts are connected, sometimes directly and sometimes obliquely, by the movements of that enormous desk. So I'm going to read to you just a tiny bit from Nadia, who's this writer who inherited the desk from Daniel Varsky, and she's sort of describing the desk a little, telling you about it. I was married for a while, she says, but now I live alone again, though not unhappily. There are moments when a kind of clarity comes over you, and suddenly you can see through walls to another dimension that you'd forgotten or chosen to ignore in order to continue living with the various illusions that make life, particularly life with other people, possible. and that's where I'd arrived at, Your Honor. If it weren't for the events I'm about to describe, I might have gone on not thinking about Daniel Varsky, or very rarely, though I was still in possession of his bookshelves and his desk. The sofa he gave me began to rot. I don't exactly remember when, but I had to throw it away. At times I thought of getting rid of the rest, too. It reminded me, when I was in a certain mood, of things I would rather forget. For example, sometimes I'm asked by the occasional journalist who wishes to interview me why I stopped writing poetry. Either I say that the poetry I wrote wasn't good, perhaps it was even terrible, or I say that a poem has the potential for perfection and this possibility finally silenced me. Or sometimes I say that I felt trapped in the poems I tried to write, which is like saying one feels trapped in the universe or trapped by the inevitability of death. But the truth of why I stopped writing poetry is not any of these. Not nearly, not exactly. The truth is that if I could explain why I stopped writing poetry, then I might write it again. What I'm saying is that Daniel Varsky's desk, which became my desk of more than 25 years, reminded me of these things. I'd always considered myself only a temporary guardian and had assumed a day would come after which, all but with mixed feelings, I would be relieved of my responsibility of living with and watching over the furniture of my friend, the dead poet Daniel Varsky, and that from then on I would be free to move as I wished, possibly even to another country. It isn't exactly that the furniture had kept me in New York, but if pressed, I have to admit this was the excuse I'd used for not leaving all those years, long after it became clear the city had nothing left for me. And yet when that day came, it sent my life, at last solitary and serene, reeling. So that's Nadia and her desk and my desk. If I was blind to the origin of that fictional desk when I wrote the story, for a long time, I was also blind to the critical role that the desk was beginning to play in the slowly emerging novel. I've never written my books with any sort of plan or blueprint in mind, preferring to pursue accidents and intuitions. The eventual structure always rises out of words and narratives as they unfold, and for much of the writing, I'm lost and uncertain, with only a mood and enduring preoccupations to guide me. The more experienced a writer I become, the more I've come to depend on this uncertainty, the deeper I've dropped myself in the woods each time, and the farther apart I've plotted the starting points of paths that will eventually have to converge, or at the very least sum to something. This time I began to write in the voices of four characters with very different lives happening far from each other in space and sometimes time. I had no sense of why they should live together under the same roof, even if they should live together at all. So you've heard from one, the writer Nadia, who's forced to give up her desk. And as I was expanding her story, I also began to write in a number of other voices, one of which was an elderly Israeli father addressing his estranged son. So around this time, I went to visit a friend of mine, who's a painter, at her studio. My friend has one of the most bizarre and spontaneous imaginations I've ever encountered, and I always like hearing her talk about her ideas. So on this day, among the various unfinished canvases that were hanging in her studio, there was one showing people lying around in a large hall with some cots on the floor, and the painting had a title already. The title was How We Cured the Plague. And standing on a ladder, my friend began to describe how she thought she might paint a huge shark lying across the foreground to which one of these patients might be attached somehow via tubes. So after that, we talked about other things, and I said goodbye to my friend, and I went home. But the still unpainted image of that terrible shark stayed with me. I knew without knowing why or how that something of the novel I wanted to write was embodied in that shark, or rather in the relationship between the shark and the person, or perhaps even people, who would be receiving something from it, or maybe even channeling something to it through those tubes and wires. So I began to write what I thought would be an entire novel about a shark and some dreaming people attached to it, until after many pages of what turned out to be the wrong direction, the story began to sink deeper and deeper, becoming smaller and smaller, until it became entirely submerged in the other stories that rose up around it. In the end, it became simply a book that one of the characters, this estranged son, who's the son of the Israeli father, writes as a very young man before he leaves writing behind and becomes a lawyer and then later a judge. So here's the father, whose name is Aaron, remembering the book as he addresses his now grown estranged son. So this is not my voice anymore. This is Aaron. "I don't support the plan," I told you. "Why?" you demanded with little angry eyes. "What will you write?" I asked. You told me a convoluted story about 4, 6, maybe 8 people all lying in rooms joined by a system of electrodes and wires to a great white shark. All night the shark floats, suspended in an illuminated tank, dreaming the dreams of these people. No, not the dreams, the nightmares, the things too difficult to bear. So they sleep, and through the wires, the terrifying things leave them and flood into the awesome fish with scarred skin that can bear all the accumulated misery. After you finished, I let a sufficient amount of silence pass before I spoke. "Who are these people?" I asked. "People," you said. I ate a handful of nuts, watching your face. "I don't know where to begin on the problems with this little story," I told you. "Problems," you said, and your voice rising and cracking. In the wells of your eyes, your mother saw the suffering of a child raised by a tyrant, but in the end, the fact that you never became a writer had nothing to do with me. And here's that father again later in the novel, describing how he secretly read the pages that his son wrote. All throughout your army service, before what happened to you, you used to send packages home addressed to yourself. Your mother passed on your instructions that these packages were not to be touched except to be placed in a drawer of your desk. You lavished no end of tape on them so that you would know if anyone tampered with them. Well, guess what? I did. I opened them and I read the contents and then I closed them back up exactly as you had, with more tape. And if you ever asked, I would have told you it was the army censors who were to blame. But you never asked. As far as I could tell, you never looked again at what you'd written. Sometimes I even convinced myself that you knew I'd broken open the packages and read what you wrote, that you meant for me to read it. And so at my leisure, when your mother was out and the house was empty, I steamed open the envelopes and read about the shark and the interconnected nightmares of many. About the janitor who cleaned the tank every night, wiping the glass and checking the tubes, and the pump that sent fresh water in, who would pause in his work to check on the feverish, shivering bodies asleep in their beds, who would lean on his mop and stare into the eyes of the tormented white beast covered in electrodes attached to tubes, who every day grew sicker and sicker from absorbing the pain of so many. So this story, this is me again here, not the father. I read this actually to my mom, and she said, "It's too confusing. You can't tell who's speaking when." So, always the critic. So the story of the shark, who becomes a repository for human sadness, was reduced to a reoccurring but very slight strand in the narrative. And yet it became a strong underground current directing the novel, a way for me to think about the book as a whole. These different voices, or I came to think of them as confessions or even dreams, that are all being channeled towards some unified point, a great beast floating in an illuminated tank. Later on in the writing, it also dawned on me that the shark was yet another metaphor for the burden of inheritance, of how children absorb into their being the dreams and the sadnesses of their parents. At about the same time that these other preoccupations, Chile and the desk and the shark and parents and children, were taking on their fictional shapes, I found myself thinking a lot about the studio of the painter Francis Bacon. Bacon painted out of the same room in London for 31 years, and his studio was an overwhelmingly chaotic accumulation of slashed canvases and brushes and rags encrusted with paint and torn magazines and trampled sketches and everything just left to lie wherever it had fallen over the course of 3 decades. So the studio itself became, if not a work of art, then a violent statement about what it is, what it was to Bacon, to create. Some years after he died in 1992, it was broken down into tens of thousands of parts, packed into boxes and fastidiously reassembled whole again, down to the last spatter of paint in a museum in Dublin. There's a feeling I sometimes get, and this must be the case for all writers, when something I come across seems, for reasons I can't explain, to scratch in a pleasing way an until then unreachable itch. The idea of this very complex room dismantled in one place and reassembled with exquisite care in another scratched such an itch for me. From Bacon's studio, I found myself wandering to another such reassembled room, Freud's study in London, where I myself had spent a fair bit of time. When Freud left Vienna in 1938, fleeing the Gestapo, almost all of his belongings were crated up and shipped to the new house in London, where his wife and daughter lovingly reassembled, down to the last possible detail, the study he'd been forced to abandon at 19 Burggasse. Maybe all exiles try to recreate the place they've lost out of their fear of dying in a strange place. And yet when I was living in London and spent quite a lot of time in Freud's study, comforted by the hominess of the place and the sight of all his little figurines and statuettes, I was often struck by the irony that Freud, who shed more light than anyone onto the crippling burden of memory, had been unable to resist its mythic spell any better than the rest of us. After he died in 1939, his daughter, Anna Freud, preserved the room exactly as her father left it, down to the glasses he removed from the bridge of his nose and laid on the desk for the last time. From 12 to 5, Wednesday through Sunday, you can visit this room that stalled forever at the moment the man who gave us some of our most enduring ideas of what it is to be a person ceased to be. So now I was thinking about these two transplanted rooms, although I guess it's only now in retrospect that the thoughts seem to possess a kind of coherent architecture. And I began to consider how in both cases it wasn't only the objects in each room that possessed such powerful talismanic significance to Bacon and to Freud and then later to us, but their precise placement and order in the rooms, an order that others would later obsessively, meticulously reassemble and almost religiously preserve. I found myself wanting to invent a room like that for myself, one that I could examine and experiment with. So soon I was imagining a man, a Hungarian antique dealer named Weiss, who lives in a stone house in Jerusalem where he reassembles, piece by painstaking piece, the lost study of his father plundered by the Nazis from Budapest in 1944. For 50 years, he labors to recreate the study down to the last millimeter, down to the velvet of the heavy drapes and the pencils and the ivory tray, as if by putting all the pieces back together, he might collapse time. The only thing that's missing is his father's desk. Where it should have been, there was a gaping hole. Without it, the study remained incomplete, a poor replica. So here's Weiss, and this is the last character that I'll read to you tonight. So he's talking here about his business. I find it difficult to describe my work to others. I'm not in the habit of talking about myself. My business has always been to listen. People come to me, and at first they don't say much, but slowly it comes out. They look out the window at their feet, at some point behind me in the room. They don't meet my eyes. Because if they were to remember that I was there, they might not be able to say the words. They begin to talk, and I go with them back to their childhoods before the war. Between their words, I see the way the light fell across the wooden floor, the way he lined his soldiers up under the hem of the curtain, how she laid out the little toy teacups. Their childhoods, you see, because it's only the ones who were children who come to me now. The others have died. When I first started my business, it was mostly lovers or husbands who had lost their wives, wives who had lost their husbands. Even parents, though very few, most would have found my services unbearable. The ones that came hardly spoke at all, only enough to describe a little child's bed or the chest where he kept his toys. Like a doctor, I listen without saying a word, but there's one difference. When all of the talking is through, I produce a solution. It's true, I can't bring the dead back to life, but I can bring back the chair they once sat in, the bed where they slept. There's an amazement that comes over each one when at last I produce the object they've been dreaming of for half a lifetime, that they've invested with the weight of their longing. It's like a shock to their system. They've bent their memories around a void, and now the missing thing has appeared. I admit there were times when it was impossible to find the exact table or chest or chair that my clients were seeking. The trail reached a dead end or never began at all. Things don't last forever. The bed that one man remembers as the place where his soul was overwhelmed is, to another man, just a bed. And when it breaks or goes out of style or is no longer of use to him, he throws it away. But before he dies, the man whose soul was overwhelmed needs to lie down in that bed one more time. He comes to me. He has a look in his eyes, and I understand him. So even if it no longer exists, I find it. Do you understand what I'm saying? I produce it, out of thin air if need be. And if the wood is not exactly as he remembers, or the legs are too thick or too thin, he'll only notice for a moment of shock and disbelief. And then his memory will be invaded by the reality of the bed standing before him, because he needs it to be that bed where she once lay with him more than he needs to know the truth. You understand? And if you ask me whether I feel guilty, whether I feel I am cheating him, the answer is no. Because at the moment that man reaches out and runs his hand across the rail, for him, there are no other beds in the world. I'm often asked about the inspiration for my books, a term, this is me talking again, note to Mom, a term that to me suggests something romantic and almost mystical bestowed out of the blue. And so my reply has always been the same. I'm never struck by inspiration. Writing as I know it involves a great deal of sweaty will and labor spent pursuing arbitrary things that often amount to nothing. But it seems to me now that that answer really isn't true, or not entirely true, and that the truth lies somewhere between magical inspiration and earthly toiling. I once heard that paleontologists spend days or weeks walking an area where they think they are likely to find a fossil. At last, they will spot a loose knuckle or a claw or something, and they begin digging. If their instincts are right, that small fragment would lead them to unearth a dinosaur, which all along they had been walking back and forth above. To me, writing is like that, wandering back and forth, I'm struck by a desk or a shark or a room, and though I can't yet say why or how or where, I sense that these ideas will, if I work hard and long enough, lead me to something large that, for the time being, is still a mystery to me. Thank you. So I think we're going to now do something much less formal and hopefully have more of a conversation. If anyone has a question, just raise your hand, and I think we have some mics that will be brought to you. Yes, sorry, you.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to hear you speak, and I really appreciate it. Your work has meant a lot to me. I really loved how in the history of love, how you incorporated a lot of Hasidic, well, not a lot, but some Hasidic Jewish theology a little bit into that story. And I wondered if you could speak to or talk a little bit about how much your personal religious or theological beliefs sort of affect your work, and if you incorporated any Judaism into Great House, and how much you even think about that when you write, or if you think about it at all, or if it just happens naturally, or if it's something that you just arbitrarily toil toward, or something that... Anyway, so I'm going to stop talking
question.
And let you
I
answer.
I got it. That's good.
Thank you.
I often am asked about sort of Jewish themes in my book and whether I consider myself a Jewish novelist, and the answer to that is always I just don't consider myself, or I try not to. It seems to me a dangerous thing to do. But I am aware, and as time passes, become only more so, of what an enormous gift it is to have inherited, for me, really an intellectual tradition. I am not a religious person at all. I never have been and wasn't brought up that way. But though Great House is not, the characters in Great House are, for the most part, Jewish, but they don't go on about that much at all. But what the book is filled with, and I'll get to the Jewishness in a minute, is doubt and uncertainty. I mean, it began with my own doubt, which I talked a little bit about just now, a kind of willful uncertainty that I hold myself to in my process. But in this case, it began to seep into my characters, and they're filled with different kinds of doubt. I mean, the self-doubt of the writer, Nadia, who can't, this question keeps rising up in her, what if I've been wrong to dedicate my life to my art and sacrifice everything else? Or the moral doubt of that Israeli father about what kind of father he'd been, or a kind of doubt that haunts many of the characters about how well known we can ever be to one another. And I realized as I was writing the book that that doubt, in a way, was kind of my Jewish inheritance. I mean, a doubt is a most universal thing, but there seems to be no other religion which takes doubt so seriously as Judaism does. And, I mean, you know, one of the things I love, it's in the Talmud and in Talmudic discussion, it's considered a failure if any argument is resolved or if any argument is ultimately rejected by the rabbis. An argument should be held aloft for as long as possible, even if it reaches a kind of absurdity. And to me, that's a kind of, I mean, there's a kind of brilliance that the interest in the question, in the argument, in the tension of the argument, rather than in the kind of consoling answer. I mean, Judaism is perhaps unique in that it's a religion that offers no sense of what happens after death, really. I mean, why even have a religion if there's no consolation about what happens afterwards, it seems to me? And yet there you have it. And there's something about that tradition of questioning and doubt, which obviously became critical to this book, but is really what I see as kind of my Jewish inheritance. Yes. Next question. Yes.
You mentioned not writing for a year after your first child was born, and I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about how your writing life has been affected now that you have two children.
Yeah.
What does it look like, and how do you manage it?
Well, I thought for a while after I had my first child that I wasn't sure that I would be able to write in the same way that I could before, because for a while the ambition was knocked out of me. There seemed to be little else worth doing while this young person existed in the world, and that was incredibly frightening as somebody who was always ambitious about trying to create. But then with time, I sort of began to work on this novel, and then I had a second son while I was finishing it. The book is dedicated to my children, in part because I simply wouldn't have written this book without having become a mother, which is to say it's not about motherhood at all. It's not about like becoming a parent for the first time. And it's unfortunately much darker than that, because that's quite a happy and bright thing, complicated but happy in my experience. But you can't have an experience like bringing children to the world without it opening depths that were not available to you before. I mean, it sort of explodes huge wells of vulnerability and feeling and fragility. And it seems to me that those kind of abysses became things that I drew on in this work. And I think sometimes I find it's easier to write about something by writing about the absence of it. So I couldn't possibly write about parenthood by writing what I know of it. I had to come at it from a different way. Other questions? This gentleman over here.
As you described your process, there was a lot of mystical feelings that I felt from your description of how you got an idea and it evolved and it got connected with other pieces, etc. I wonder if you could talk about mysticism and what role it plays in your work.
Very little, actually. I mean, I think it's, I make it sound mystical, and maybe that there might be a mysticism that I'm unaware of. I suppose the best mysticism one isn't aware of. But in my case, I mean, I often hear writers talk about their like ideas sort of hitting them like fly balls, and their characters who walk off the page and begin to have tea with them or converse with them or walk down. I've never had that experience ever. I mean, writing is just such hard work. It just seems like this like incredible labor, and it can be so boring and terrible sometimes and difficult, and there's tremendous anxiety, but the most sort of consistent thing it is hard work. So I don't feel at all like writing is something mystical, but I understand why you would get that sense, because there is a way in which by trusting intuition, by not insisting in advance on a set path, you do open the door to things. But what I feel I'm opening the door to are accidents that then I hope my intellect or creative, my aesthetic will seize and make something out of. It's a way of opening sort of more doors and becoming lost in order to discover things I wouldn't have otherwise found. But I don't sort of, it's not like I sort of wait to be struck by God or something like that. Yeah. Who else? Oh, way in the back, in the middle there.
Really pull together?
No, but I don't go through that many drafts, but I do rewrite as I'm right, you know, as it sort of happens. But I'm also, I mean, by now I know what I'm looking for. So by writing the books in this way, I mean, The History of Love was written like this too, which is, you know, creating a number of different stories, remote points that I know, I hope, are going to draw together. And I'm looking for coherence. I'm looking for echoes and symmetries. I'm looking for where the joints of these stories are. And those echoes are going to tell me more about the characters than I would have otherwise known. So I know kind of what to look for. Also, I have to say that obviously the architecture of my novels is very important to me. I tend to build from inside, which is like, you know, the doorknob first, and then the door, and then the room, and then, you know, many rooms. And then eventually, when the book is nearing completion, I finally get to see it from the outside and say, ah, here's what the whole thing looks like. But this, there's a kind of deliberateness in building the structure, even though I don't yet know where that room or door or window will be. And sometimes I do have to move things around, but it feels very architectural to me. I feel like a woodworker or something like that a lot of the time. Or maybe another way to think of it is kind of like a musical, like writing a musical score, where you have certain things that are going to be playing off each other, certain instruments that are going to be harmonizing. And so I'm in a way as interested in that as I am in each individual story or the language or anything else. Yes.
You were one of the 10 young writers that the New Yorker picked.
Alas, there were 20.
20. Thank you. I was never good at numbers, but so I'm just wondering what you thought about all of that. You know, there have been several really wonderful young writers that have gotten acclaim as you have, and has this helped you, your career? What do you think about this whole focus?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure it's helped, and I think there are lots of great writers who weren't chosen, and then there's something, I mean, like any kind of prize, it just depends on the judge, and a different judge would have chosen different writers. So, but I do feel tremendously grateful. I mean, The History of Love was published there as an excerpt before I'd finished it, actually, and I feel that all this time I've had so much warmth from the editors there and support, and I think that makes a world of difference. But to be frank, I don't find that the best thing about all of that is that I get to write another book. Like, it gives me the opportunity to write more, but it doesn't really change my sense of how hard and like my anxiety as a writer, frankly. And in fact, the older I get, and it's not that the accolades make me anxious, it's just that I begin not to trust them, really, because I have always been aware of like the flaws of my book, the failures, and how I wish that they were better, and I keep wanting to write the book that somehow I was meant to write. I don't know if I ever will. But I am so deeply aware of those things, those shortcomings, that in a way one begins to trust praise less and less, which is a shame. But that's how it is. Yes.
One of the things I really admire about your books is how you have many different characters from different walks of life living in different time periods and countries. And I was just wondering how much research, if any, you do to make it historically accurate?
I guess I'm not very patient with research. I thought for a long time that if the writing career didn't work out, I would remain in academia, but I kept getting in trouble as an academic because I would just take these sort of flights of fancy and never really back up my ideas with research. So luckily the writing career worked out. I feel like one of the great privileges I have as a writer is this enormous freedom that writing affords one. I mean, when you think about it, in life we are so limited in what we're allowed to be and do and say. And in writing, you know, every time you look at, like, the blank page, I guess now the blank computer screen, we should say, anything is possible. And you can say anything. You don't have to publish it. You can try anything. You can also become anyone, which I find really thrilling. I mean, obviously part of becoming someone is also discovering yourself. But there's, like, no other place where you can so fully examine what it is to live another life. And I think that's the same for, I think that's why we read ultimately. I mean, reading is so, books or literature is so rare and so unlike the other arts in that it gives us this opportunity to step so fully and vividly, like, into the stream of another inner life. And we actually can, like, imagine what it is to be another. And I think, you know, it forms tremendous empathy in us, really. But I think that's, yeah, one of what I love about the work. And I don't ever feel like I want to spend too much time having to be, like, check reality, really. The places that I write about are all, like, places for my life. And, I mean, I'll probably keep writing about the same places. It's not, like, new and, like, Panama is not going to suddenly be a main setting in my work or anything. My mom is from London, my dad grew up in Israel, and my grandparents all came from different places in Europe. And I feel like part of what I do when I'm writing a novel is, like, trying to create a sense of home, which has been a somewhat elusive idea in my life because my family is from so many places. And so I'm, like, endlessly stitching these places together. So sometimes I'll have to, like, research a street name that I forgot, but it's not ever much more than that. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is there any criticism you've received that you've rejected along the way?
I take it all. I take it and absorb it all. In fact, I'm often told that I should stop doing that somehow. But I say that, and it really is true. I mean, the good reviews just bounce right off me as if I never read them, and the bad reviews keep reverberating. But and, like, you know, like, when I delivered that talk, my mom said the problem was, it was really great, but the problem is you can't tell who's reading. That's what I remembered of that, you know, giving that talk. I have a kind of stubbornness as a writer, and I am who I am. I mean, it hurts to be misunderstood or to feel one's been misunderstood, but it doesn't change how I write. And I keep feeling this tremendous, like, shock at having found so many readers. It was not ever part of the plan. I mean, I'm grateful. I love it, but it wasn't part of the plan. And with this book too. I mean, I really try to write whatever I think I need to or I'm meant to write, whether it's going to be work for the reader or for the critic or not. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it doesn't. Yes, back there.
Thank you. Given what you call the architecture of your fiction, would you say that as you're writing it, you're consciously writing from page 1 to page 300, or are you not writing in sequence, or is that something that doesn't even occur to you?
No, I tend to write more or less in sequence. Like, this seems to, nobody really believes me, and I don't know why when I say this, but The History of Love was written from the first page to the last in exactly that order, and I never knew what was going to happen. And in fact, until the end, it was this, like, terrible anxiety about who was going to be the last voice. I don't know how many people have read this, but it was Leo and Alma, and how could one have the last word over the other? And I remember just walking down this, like, 23rd Street one day and realizing, wait, how could they speak at the same time? How can human characters speak at the same time? And it seemed like this typographical problem that you can't have two voices at the same time without it being confusing. And then I thought, well, what if they just alternate pages? And it was this stroke of, like, like this book will end. It's found its end. It will come to an end now. It's going to work out. And all these years of working, like, but it depended on this final decision because nothing else would have been okay. And so I think there, I get myself into these corners where the entirety of the book rests on getting something very small right. And I don't take very many notes at all when I write, but I have one notebook that my dad, like this journal my dad gave me 10 years ago, that he gave me all these fancy journals that seemed far too fancy to write anything in. And, but one of them, I took some notes for my first novel, and then there were so few notes, there was room for my second novel, and then I wrote the notes for Great House, and there's probably room for like five more novel notes there because I take so few. But the kind of notes I take are, there's two kinds. One is pictorial, early on in the writing, just endless characters' names with arrows. Like, is this one the daughter of this one? Does this one crash her car into this one? Who is the judge speaking? I mean, just trying to figure out how they relate to each other, and it's a very spatial kind of thing. And then the other kind of note comes later, and they're like mathematical notes, like trying to get the chronology right. Because, of course, if you sort of like free associate and write what you want, that's all good and well. But if such and such character has to meet such and such character on a boat, if one is on the boat in 1946 and the other in 1948, the whole story doesn't work. So I find myself in these like terrible sort of twister, you know, that game Twister where you put, it's these positions where somehow I have to unknot things to get it right. But somehow, so far, it's worked, but the next novel might be a disaster. Who knows? So, yes.
Thank you. I'm trying to write short stories, and I'm actually participating in this crazy thing, the National Novel Writing Month, which many Philadelphians are involved in. Would you see? I love your idea of just going with... Can I just enter into this with very little plot and very little characters and just see what comes out and write the whole month like that? I mean, I'm trying to see how I can approach this, you know?
Well, I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Well, I just meant this is the method you use, that you really don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, but there are people who cycle without helmets, and there are people who walk around naked, and we don't do that ourselves. So I don't know. I mean, it just worked for me somehow. But I guess what I would say to any writer who was looking for some sense of guidance would be, like, this idea of freedom seems to me so crucial, both in like your pleasure as a writer and then ultimately the reader's pleasure. Because anything that feels too calculated will be boring for you to write and then won't be thrilling to read. I think the idea, I mean, I remember there was a book I read around the time that I finished my first novel. It's a shame I didn't read it before I wrote my first novel, but it's David Grossman, an Israeli writer, wrote a novel called See Under Love. Yeah, and it's a novel that really breaks every rule. I mean, if you ever thought that there was a rule that a novel should follow, it breaks it. And I found that so exciting. And so many of the writers that I love have taught me that lesson again and again because it's easy to forget. But this idea that anything is possible in the novel, that, I mean, really as a form, it lacks definition. It's very unusual. I mean, so many other art forms have a clearer definition of what they are. But when you think of what is a novel, like, it's a long story with a beginning and an end, and that's all and we can really say about it. And it seems to me that that flexibility or that lack of definition is actually an opportunity, maybe even a privilege, and that each time you sit down to write a novel, it's given to you to redefine what a novel is or what it can be. And I think if you think about it that way, it becomes much more exciting, much more liberating. Yes. In the middle. Oh, wait, who's saying this? Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, yeah.
I actually saw Leo and Bruno at the airport last week, but
I see them all the time too.
I think I mean, I think everyone in here is probably a reader. So I think that books, you know, can hold a very personal thing for people, and you have a relationship with them after a while. And I know that there are a few books that I carry around with me that I have a personal relationship with and I, you know, really love. And I was just wondering if there was an author or a book that you have a personal relationship with or that you refer back to. Maybe
yeah,
when you write.
A lot. I have a little shelf over my desk, that terrible desk. It has so many shelves, I don't know what to put in them all. But one of the shelves holds the, like books that I really return to and will probably all my life. So thinking about what's on that, I mean, I guess I always hate to say that I have a favorite writer because I have so many, but among them, definitely very high on the list would be Samuel Beckett. And I think I reread his work with more regularity than any other writer. Like a book, a novel like Malloy, I've read like way too many times to count, or a play like Endgame, which seems to me like a perfect work of art if there ever was one. Or Crap's Last Tape, which is another one of his plays, which had a huge influence on my work, I think. And then I'm going to give you some weird choices that you probably haven't necessarily heard of because it seems like that's what we should do, get you to read books that you wouldn't otherwise. There's the Polish writer Bruno Schulz, who appears in, I mean, he not, but his book appears in The History of Love, which is The Street of Crocodiles is one of my favorite books of all time. I mean, just the most tremendous imagination of any writer ever, maybe. I love the writer Thomas Bernhard, the Austrian writer, who's so misanthropic. And, you know, I sometimes wish that I could be like that, but I'm not. And then there's a, it seems worth mentioning a poet, since they don't seem to get mentioned anymore anywhere. There's a Polish poet called Zbigniew Herbert, who I think taught me a lot about what kind of writer I wanted to be. I mean, seems to, like a writer who sort of like holds everything, like the whole universe kind of in his hand when he writes, and can, it's just a beautiful writer. And his books, I think some of his books are out of print, but if you buy, if you look for them, only look for the translations of The Carpenters, just a husband and wife team, because they did a new book of translations and they're not very good. But The Carpenters are his, like they translated him like angels. I mean, amazing. So, yes. One more question. Is there one? Yes, over here.
Your bio mentioned that you previously studied poetry. Could you talk about how that influences your writing and how you began writing fiction?
Yeah. I mean, I began writing fiction just as a... I thought it was going to be a way to start writing poetry again. I mean, that little bit I read tonight is more or less faithful to my experience, the bit that Nadia talks about not being able to write, feeling trapped by poems. I basically had reached a stage at 25, which is when I wrote my first novel, where all of that freedom that I've been describing somehow got sapped out of my writing, and the poems were getting shorter and smaller. And I thought, maybe if I could try writing this one of these novel things that would somehow remind me, maybe this other form, and I would sort of forget what I was doing, and I would get lost again and feel free and go back to writing poems. And then I just discovered that, like, the novel fit me so perfectly for the reasons I described earlier about this kind of formlessness or the openness of the form, but also like the messiness of the imperfection of it. Like, if because the form is so sort of cloudy, it's always endlessly flawed. Like, there is no perfect novel, and there's something about that sort of messiness and that this endless sort of doors falling off hinges and corners not quite meeting that really appeals to me. And also this sense of the longness of the project, the way that, like, you wake up every day and it's still there for you to think about, and it becomes this massive structure with a place for every concern, every obsession, every mood that you're living through over those years. So I just found it was, like, this ideal form for me, and somehow, for a while I kept saying that when I got older and wiser I would write poems, but I think that's a lie. I don't think I'll ever write. I love writing novels, so I'll just be a reader of poems probably for the rest of my life. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.